Welcome back, everyone, to the next module in Lean Software Fundamentals, which is System Over Individual Optimization. And this is, frankly, one of my favorites because we get to play a game. It's called the Penny Game. We do it with basically every time we do this kind of a course or this type of training. Love playing the game, and we get to play it with folks. So now this is virtual. And it's probably not going to work for you at home to get your own pile of coins. However, we've enlisted the aid of a couple people, special guests, and we'll be bringing them on in just a moment to play the game. But first, let's set the stage for what we're going to be talking about in system optimization versus individual optimization. So back on the slides, again, the module overview is very simple. Why you should care, we do some definitional things, and then your new mantra. What is this mantra going to be? Mantra?
I go with mantra.
I will go with that. Specialists versus silos. This is kind of a key one, and I think both of us have some good stories to tell as to where we might want to go with this. Finding a balance. Again, striking the balance between making sure that your individuals are performing well and that the system is performing well, because that's going to optimize that flow that we talked about in the last session. And then combating local optimization. This is another key one that we get to talk about. Local optimization sounds good, and it sounds great if your team is the one optimizing yourselves. However, if you're optimizing your team at the expense of everyone else, that can cause a pretty substantial slowdown in the amount of actual value delivered. So we're going to want to avoid that. And last, we'll talk, of course, about the cultural impacts of those change. So system over individual optimization. And here's this tweetable comment. did you purposefully put these in tweetable sizes?
I like bullet-pointed sentences. They're just one of my favorite things to do. If you can't sum it up in a single sentence, then your topic just... You shouldn't be talking about it anyways.
Well, then I'm going to
understand it well enough.
I'll let you talk to this one.
Okay, so the idea behind this whole module is you always optimize the flow of value for the entire system, not through any particular point in the system, and that's this is related directly to the size of your organization, how important this becomes. Smaller organizations, when they're looking at local optimizations, typically that's usually the whole system. But when you're looking at a larger organization that has multiple stages, and maybe you're talking about creative plus development work plus some hardware work, you have to look at optimizing the flow through that entire system. In a system like that, optimizing your entire development division, all of your development division, if you optimized that and made it run as fast as it possibly could at the highest rates of utilization possible, and they're just cranking out stuff as fast as they possibly can, and that doesn't align with creative and the hardware components of what you're delivering, you've just broken your whole system, because you're piling queues up behind other parts of your system that's going to drastically decrease the throughput of value. So it's very important to consider the entire system, not just a single piece.
And we're going to see that when we look at individuals being non-optimized pretty aggressively during the demonstration, and then the system actually getting better.
Right.
So, why do you care? First of all, local optimizations very often negatively impact the flow of value through the entire system. Whew, that's a big sentence. Again, very clear, however, if you take a look at something like the world's best tester tool in our organization. So, let's say we're using Team Foundation Server and we're aligning all the flow of value through the development organization in one tool, where we have one centralized piece, and where everybody can get data, we share data, et cetera. And someone comes in and says, but company XYZ has just released test superstar whatever product, right? Some amazing product that's geared just for testers. And we've found that by taking all the stuff that was in Team Foundation Server and pulling it away and putting it in its own silo and making our testers 20% more effective at their testing, that might be a bad thing. And it can be a pretty dramatically bad thing if the developers are impacted negatively based on not being able to communicate effectively with the testers. In fact, if you've listened to the MVA Academy where we talked about the testing tools and the testing framework, that was specifically a design choice Microsoft made, which was to optimize the developer experience when the testers discovered bugs, so they would get those actionable bugs. It's a interesting trade-off. I just wanted to throw that in there because we do have some concrete examples right from here at Microsoft. Anyway, individual optimizations do another thing. They tend to create small specialized units or specialists, and those specialists then tend to only want to work on the things that they are specialists in because they're very good at that. That specialization then reduces flexibility through the system. Now, we're going to give another example of this when we talk about specialist teams versus generalist teams a little bit later in the section. So we'll see this in a concrete example. Now, that individual optimizations with silos and de-emphasizing teamwork, what do you mean de-emphasizing teamwork? That sounds like a cultural thing, Andrew. Can you?
Yeah, it is a bit of a cultural thing. So when we look at optimizing the way an individual, if we look at optimizing an individual, we're measuring them on metrics that are only related to that individual instead of how that individual interacts with the system. As we discussed earlier, and we took it as axiomatic, that software development, modern software development, is a flow-based system. It's a system of multiple trade-offs. So if we attempt to optimize at the individual level, what we're explicitly saying is what's most important for you to do is your job, as opposed to what's most important for us to do is deliver value to our customers. And it's a paradigm shift in management to say, it's more important for me to deliver value than it is for you to be highly efficient at what you're doing.
This is an interesting thing. Andrew and I both worked together on a project, and one of those tells on the team is when someone on the team says, well, I'm done with my job. I'm done with my part. Right. And our ears perked up immediately, and we thought, wait a minute. You're thinking that you're done with your job when the value hasn't yet even been to the customer's hands, not even in a beta format? Absolutely not. You're not done with your job until the customer feels it, can see it, whether that's in a beta product, however that is. That sentence, I'm done with my part, is how you can tell if you're trying to optimize your teams around individual performance. Now, there's the new mantra. And I love this new mantra. Again, perfectly tweetable, and you said it, so I'm gonna let it go. Throw that back.
All right. It's okay to be locally less than perfectly efficient if doing so increases the flow of value through the system. It's totally okay to be less than efficient at the individual. And we use the term individual a lot, but what we really mean is lower than system level, right? So if you're talking about a multi-division organization, when we say individual, we could be talking about something as large as an entire division of your organization, right? It's less than system level. But it's okay to make one of those things less efficient in order to deliver value to your customer at the pace that you need to be delivering value to them. Goldratt's theory of constraints was sort of the first evolution of this. Reinertsen has evolved this idea to take more into account the economics of queues and how it's more of a trade-off than a subjugation system. But the bottom line is, decreasing efficiency can improve overall efficiency, and it's okay to do that.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the hardest things for people to grasp. And so, to demonstrate this, and to be more concrete, we'd like to do a demonstration. It's called the penny game, for lack of a better term. And what we're going to do on the penny game is invite up some of our key guests. So first, if we'll have Matt come back. This is Matt Calder. He is very commonly found on the Q&A panel. He is the MVA publisher, and this course would not, well, in fact, none of MVA would be possible without Matt. Next, we'd like to introduce Pete Harris. Pete is the MVA content manager for ALM Wednesdays. So if you like these ALM pieces, you can thank you can thank both, but you can especially thank Pete because Pete had the idea and kind of ran with these. So huge thanks. to the both of you.
I knew what I was getting myself into.
And now they're both here.
Yes.
On camera to show the penny game. Now.
All right, let's grill them.
So what do you know about... So, what we have are coins. We just have a couple coins, and I'm going to explain the game to you guys. And the game is very, very simple. We normally have 50 coins. We're going to do 30. And I'm going to have 30. They're all heads or tails up. I'm going to do some work. Then I'm going to pass it to Pete. Pete's going to do some work. He's going to pass it over to Matt, and Matt's going to pass it on to Andrew. Now, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to be incredibly locally efficient. And the way to be locally efficient is for me to be able to flip my pennies with both hands as fast as I possibly can. So my goal, and I want all my pennies in front of me because I don't want anybody slowing me down. I'm going to flip over the pennies as quickly as I possibly can. And then when all 30 are flipped, I'm going to pass them to you.
Okay.
Pete's going to flip all 30. He's going to pass them to Matt. When Matt finishes all 30, he's going to pass them to Andrew. And then the timer, we're going to time this thing. The timer goes, we're done. So, are you ready? This is just go one. We're going to do this thing twice. But the first one, we're going to flip. And I'm going to go first. On your mark, get set, go.
I love how he gave himself, are you mark? Get set. Yeah, like pushing the button and starting flipping.
Oh, come on. I can be faster than this.
He's done this before, you can tell.
Yeah. Oh, that would be dangerous.
You have to finish with
and I'm days. And I'm done. Your turn, all 30. Oh, quality control.
Quality control.
So for those watching at home who don't happen to have pennies, it's not a big deal. You can use Pfennig. You can use whatever you have in your currency.
Wow. You've done this a lot more often than me.
Or tiddlywinks.
We've done it a few times, I think. It's, yeah.
I'm already trying to figure out.
It's done.
How do I place them?
All right.
Next.
You're up. Go quick as you can. We're going to get this thing through. Shoot them through.
So, ready?
Yep. Yeah. Go. Okay. You don't have to wait.
Towards you to behind you.
However you like it. So the idea, folks, both hands, flip as fast as you can. And we're going to get all these pennies processed through our system. We're at a minute 10 right now. My guess is we won't be much longer.
Okay. All heads.
All heads. We're over. Lap. He's got a nice cadence going on over there. You can hear it. You can hear it clicking. Is that it? One more? Oh, it was the lost one.
It's dark in here. Thanks.
And we're done.
We're good.
All right. So, woohoo! Done with row one. What we have in this, let's go through this. I'm gonna ask Andrew to write this up for me. Myself, so Steve took a grand total of 18 seconds to finish those. I was pretty quick. We went then back over to Pete. Pete was at 30 seconds. Pete handed off to Matt, who was at 28 seconds. Oh, but the last lap, because of the quality control, went to Andrew, was also at 28 seconds. And so we are at a grand total of 1 minute, approximately 1 minute, 44 seconds. If you add up the seconds, there was some rounding going on. They may not be there. Don't get up yet, because now
we get to do it again.
We're going to do it again. But in the idea of getting rid of this optimizations, this local optimizations of each one of us trying to go as fast as we can, we're going to restrict ourselves. I am right-handed. I'm going to take my right hand and sit on it and only use my left hand, okay? Every one of you is going to do the same. You guys can't. You're kneeling. If you guys would just take your dominant hand and tuck it in the back of your pants, we'll be on our way, and we're going to do it again, this time leaving everyone completely, basically, unoptimized. In addition, you're not going to have all of them laid out before you so that you have a queue that you can constantly process through. You may have to wait as other people might be slower than you, we're going to do it one at a time. We're going to move the batch size from 30 to 1. So in this case, Andrew will start. He's going to flip over the first one, pass it on, and we're going to go one at a time as fast as we can all the way through while we're measuring. So as soon as you're done with one, flip it over and you'll pass it on down. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Get set. Okay. Go. Wow, this must be boring to watch from the people on the thing there as we're going, but...
Do you have music for us, Barry?
Do, 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 do.
The hold music. The hold music might be kind of perfect for this, I think, actually.
Oh, these are nice zoom-in of Pete and Matt over here, too. You guys are... Who thought you'd be on screen today when you showed up and got wrangled into this?
Well, I didn't plan to wear this shirt.
And we're done.
And last one. And okay, let me stop it. We've got a lap timer now. We basically have a whole new set of times. I don't know if we need to write them up there. We can talk them through. Right. But we're going to talk them through just briefly before you leave, because I want there was a couple things that I noticed while we were playing that I want to cast back to. But first of all, it took Andrew, rather than 30 seconds or 28 seconds, it took Andrew 48 seconds to get through his...
Same amount of work.
Same amount of work, 48 seconds. That's almost double. In fact, Andrew, by basis of not being able to use both hands, really was didn't have the ability to deliver so much stuff. However, all of us suffered that same thing, because you guys couldn't get it done any faster than Andrew, because Andrew was slowing down everybody, right?
Right.
However, the total time through the system worked out to be 55 seconds.
So that means from here to here, we added about plus 7 seconds.
Yes. So in other words, we just walked through the system and dramatically improved our system performance at the expense of every individual's performance. But remember what we said, if you're starved for work, you're going to look left and look right. I don't know if you guys watched carefully, and it's pretty tricky to tell, but if you noticed over here, every now and again, there was a little bit of slowdown where you weren't able to quite get them off as fast as Matt was at laying them down. So Matt was originally flipping them and laying them kind of close to himself, and you were having to reach across and pick them up. But what happened was Matt noticed that and noticed there was a queue forming here. And Matt turned to flipping and moving further, closer over to Pete. Did you even notice you were doing that?
Not really, to be honest, no. but it's just kind of subconscious. I mean, he's there, you're just so you cooperate. Yep.
Exactly. It's this cooperation that you get when you're running through there. Thank you guys very much.
Yeah.
We really appreciate you. Right? Appreciate you coming.
Thanks, guys.
Huge hand for everyone out there. It's always tough to be one of the ones kind of wrapped up and pulled into a discussion.
I love that point that you made about changing your behavior based on the flow. It's just, and it always happens. Almost every time we run this game, there's always a cue that starts to form between two people, and one person adjusts their behavior to align with the other person's, and they do it almost subconsciously. And it's such an epitome of the cultural shift that can happen when you change from individual optimization as a culture to system optimization as a culture. It just, when you make that paradigm shift, little things like that, that you can't really even begin to quantify, just happen. And you don't have to dictate them. You don't have to command and control them. They just start to happen. Anyways, that was a little soapbox.
No, that is absolutely true. I am shocked by this. Once we went to that flow model where all four of us were kind of working together to deliver this, we became a team as opposed to isolated individuals. And even though all of us were sub-optimized, we were able to get value through the system quickly. Now, the interesting thing is, and we'll get to... We'll walk this back just a wee bit when we get to talking about cues and managing cues in the next section. But the the fact is, what I hear people say is, well, everyone was just sitting around right. waiting. What they should have been doing is we should have had 120 pennies out here and everybody would be working on it all at the same time, going, 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 going. That's great. You would truly deliver more pennies to the end. But I have a quarter. And I'm going to challenge you to play this game again. And if you take a higher value currency, and if I was doing batches and I took this higher value one and dropped it into my batch of 30, it would take me processing it, the next person processing it, the next person, and finally till Andrew got it, Andrew could grab the quarter and be the first person to flip it over. Quarters, by the way, 25 times as much value as a penny. It's just a higher value piece of currency. Now, if you're playing the other way, where there's just a flow going, watch what happens. Take a higher valued piece of currency, don't say anything, just drop it into the pile. People naturally grab things they perceive as higher value and flow them through the system right away. So this is the CEO of the organization that's been treating your team as though you're walking through molasses because you're delivering so slowly. This is their item that they wanted to watch. You didn't even have to specify this massive reprioritization scheme, nothing like that. You drop it in and say, you know what, this is important. Don't stop what you're doing, but just kind of put it to the top of the queue. And whoosh, it'll flow through the system without having to preempt. This is the expensive thing in software development is when you have to preempt someone and make them stop doing what they're doing, mothball it, and work on something else. If they finish what they're doing and then start doing the next thing, it's not that big a deal. When someone wrote in the comments, and I absolutely love it, and I forget who it was, I apologize, but they made a brilliant comment. We're operating with a FIFO queue, first in, first out. If we're doing that, and we're trying to do prioritization, it's very, very difficult unless the WIP limits are small and the items we're flowing flow quickly. In that case, it almost doesn't matter what form of queue it is, because as long as somebody's able to drop something in at the top before it comes to my small personal queue, I can flow it through extremely rapidly. There's a lot of other lessons to this one. We play it with four and we play it with eight. What happens when you play it with eight people, Andrew?
When you run it through with eight people, in the flow-based model, you end up with almost the exact same cycle time. You can run this through eight people, and your overall cycle time will, or excuse me, your overall system time, since we're measuring system time here, increases linearly as opposed to exponentially if you're doing it in large batches.
Right. So an example here, if we had taken the same thing and we'd run it here, instead of 1 minute and 44 seconds in the first pass, we would have gone through, and with eight people, it would have doubled, basically. We would have been somewhere at 2 minutes, 88 seconds, or 3 minutes, 28 seconds.
Because every person right? That you're adding is adding that much cycle time.
Exactly. But, as Andrew mentioned, when you go to the flow-based model, you're only adding about 7 more seconds.
Yep.
So in other words, this is the other thing that gets me. When you start to look at the entire software development process, you really want to kind of squish it down and have just a few people with limited transitions in a lot of cases, right? Because that means you go quickly, i.e. four people. But I hear people tell me, oh no, our software is so complicated, we need 8 steps instead of 4 steps to deliver our software. Therefore, limiting WIP won't work for us. We need lots more stage gates and we're going to do it in bulk. It's exactly wrong, right? Exactly wrong. If you need to work in bulk, have a really small team. If you need to work across multiple things, multiple stages, then it's even more critical. We can run through literally 25 states and barely increase our overall cycle time, our overall system time, as long as we're doing it in small batches and pushing it through very, very rapidly. And I think that's just one of the most exciting things for me, is that when you take this game, play it a ton of times with different measures, you start to pull out interesting things.
Right.
And the most interesting, I think, was your cultural one that you mentioned.
It really is amazing how smoothly that transition happens. It's It just happens. It just, people become a team. The focus is gone from me as an individual. Notice when we're doing it individually, everyone is looking at you as an individual. How long is it going to take for you to flip all your pennies? How fast can I get through my personal pennies? And then I'm done. So now I can just sit back and relax because I'm done. When it's the flow-based model, you can't think about it that way. It's just naturally, it's just a natural human reaction. You think about the whole system as you flow, or at least the places left and right of you.
Yep.
And you just make that shift. It's very seamless.
I love that. I love that. I love the cultural change that you can drive from that. All right, let's now move from the idea of that flow system, where we're going from an optimized individual to an optimized flow, and then start talking about specialization, because that's highly related to the flow-based system as well.
Right. So one of the things that happens a lot in software development is we end up with specialists. We have UX specialists and back-end specialists and DBAs and whatever, 900 million different kinds of specialists.
No exaggeration. There,
no exaggeration. No exaggeration. Right? There are quite literally 900 million of them. As we've created all of these specialists and then measured them on utilization, in order to keep them fully utilized, we have to put a queue of work behind each one of these specialists. So each of these specialists have to have a queue so that they can always have something to work on. And they do their work, and they do it as fast as they possibly can, and then they hand that work off to a new specialist, and that new specialist also has a queue, so it goes to the back of his queue, and so on and so forth. So we chain these queues of specialists throughout our system, which just drastically increases cycle time. We did this for, that's the bad, right? So, but we've done this for a reason, and we'll talk about why balancing that might be important, but we'll stick with the bad for a little bit. The bottom line is most tasks just don't require specialists, right? Like, most software development tasks don't take someone who knows the ins and outs of the compiler, right? You don't need to be able to, in fact, oftentimes optimizing algorithms to be the most efficient and as fast as humanly possible makes them completely unreadable and totally unmaintainable. I've worked on systems where you're like, I can't understand this and I need 3 weeks to understand what the heck is going on. And there was no reason for that, you know, 0.5% gain in efficiency.
Right.
Right. So most of our tasks just don't require specialists to that level, but some do. And we'll get to how we can inject them in a little bit. Which brings me to my next point, which is use specialists for specialization, or use? That slide's wrong. That should say measure specialists for specialization.
No, you're okay,
use specialists for specialization, not efficiency. Basically, what we're saying here is the idea of you use specialists to decrease your overall response time, not to increase your efficiency. So if you've got a security specialist who comes in and helps your teams out with a piece of code that needs to be more secure than their normal operating procedures, you bring them in not to increase the efficiency of the organization, but to help them out in that particular specialization. So what you're going to be end up measuring those specialists against is their response time and not their utilization and efficiency. And I'll go into a good example of firefighters in just a second.
Well, actually, in fact, let's do
go
right
ahead
now.
And do it, because
that'll
just
make it
easier.
We're actually hitting that.
I keep trying to talk about this in abstract, and let's just talk a little bit about it in specificity. So this is one of my favorite examples for how this works. Firefighters are specialists, and so we'll go through this from the beginning to end. If you look at fighting a fire, from a small fire to a large fire, you've got a wide range of specialization required in order to combat the fire. From the low end, we can use generalists to fight a small fire, right? So in order to take advantage of this, we decentralize fire extinguishers into buildings and into homes, right? You've got a small fire, you've got a fire extinguisher, a generalist can totally take care of that. Right?
I've got one in my kitchen, I've got one in each bedroom.
Right, so I can totally take care of that. It's no big deal. Now, when you go to a larger fire, you call the fire department, and the fire department comes and sends a specialist to combat that fire. But you're not measuring that specialist based on their efficiency. In fact, you want them to be as inefficient as possible. You want to drive down their utilization rate so that when you call them, they show up, because the cost of delay of them not showing up is insanely high. Right? So if I've got a large fire, I don't want to call the fire department and be like, no, he's 90% utilized. He can get there in 4 or 5 days, right? That's not a good system. We don't want that to happen. So we drive down the utilization of our specialists in order to increase their response time, which improves the overall efficiency of the system of combating fires.
Yeah, and I think that is a great example. I want to take one firefighter example from the software world. One of the customers we've worked with, they have a, I swear they should wear berets or some special hat, but they don't work on ordinary tasks. Instead, when their website goes down, they jump into action and they get to deploy to production with no oversight. They can make changes and push directly into production without anyone else looking at their system. They're incredibly specialized people for an important role in the organization, which is website is down, we're losing hundreds of thousands of dollars an hour, we got to get it back up. They jump into action, solve the problem, and jump out. And those firefighters, if you will,
right,
run at very low utilization rates inside the organization when you think of they're working on something that is assigned to them.
Right. Yeah, if you look at that in terms of local optimization, their local optimization is terrible.
Yeah.
90% of the time, they're sitting around doing absolutely nothing. Because if they weren't sitting around doing absolutely nothing, that 10% of the time when you need to call on them to optimize the system, they'd be busy. And we can't have that. So we have to make sure we're measuring them on response time and not on their utilization or optimization rates. It's very important.
Well, one quick thing that I do want to address, and sorry to keep interrupting, but one of the things that I want to hit is they aren't doing nothing.
Right.
They are doing nothing from the perspective of their job. What that organization does, which I think is a great idea, is they have them pair program.
Right.
They take those experts, those total hotshot devs that know the system inside and out, and they come and they sit down next to other developers who are mere mortals. Like, you know, they'd be coming and sitting down with me, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. And sitting down and working with me. Now, you know, the buzzer goes off, the phone call rings, whatever. The alarm goes, the bat symbol up in the sky, whatever alerts these people, they're going to drop me like a hot potato and run in and do that. But in the meantime, I'm getting some interesting value. I'm learning how to code at their level. They're teaching me about the architecture, but they're then available for the company.
Right.
I just think it's how they did it's an interesting way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a really good model that makes sense. We can take the firefighting example to the next level of specialization, which is specialized fire types, right? We have forest fires, maybe a chemical fire, maybe a large apartment building fire that requires a ladder truck, more resources than your local fire department will necessarily have to combat. So then we have a layer of specialization above that that's even lower utilized. Because if we've got a 5-alarm fire downtown and an apartment building's on fire, we really need that ladder truck there as fast as possible, right? So you keep your ladder truck lower utilized than you would your regular fire department. Because as your level of specialization increases, your level of utilization needs to decrease or your specialization is wasted. You're just wasting that specialist because all you're doing then is building queues inside your system that increase your cycle time and lower your overall system efficiency.
The way you put that, I think, is pretty strong. I think how we can combat those is to take a look at the next slide, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about teams. So when you combat the local optimizations, one incredibly powerful way is to put everybody together in a cross-functional team. If you've got specialists in there, that might be okay,
right,
but you keep them together so that they're all responsible for delivering value. Now, on top of those, you put T-shaped individuals.
Right.
And T-shaped individuals are, if you remember the Kanban board, they look left, look right. They're the ones that I have a specialty in development. But, you know, it's a really deep specialty. But I have a little bit of experience in database work, a little bit in testing, a little bit in requirements engineering. I've got a T-shaped individual, basically, so that when I'm not being utilized in my domain, I can just step out a little bit, maybe not be as efficient, but, or even as effective, but I can at least deliver the software and unblock other people potentially.
One of the, so to bring back in the idea of layered specialists with cross-functional teams, your cross-functional team is probably going to have some T-shaped people and maybe a couple domain specialists. Maybe you've got a UX person or something like that. But typically, in larger organizations, you have another layer of specialization on top of that. Maybe your senior architects, usually maybe security specialists, something like that. And so that's how the layers of specialization comes into play. And the way you keep your senior architects from being a bottleneck is by not measuring them on utilization, but measuring them based on their response time. So you really have to treat that second layer of specialists in your organization as a service center and measure them based on their response time.
I think that is brilliant. The response time measurement gives managers something to measure,
right?
If they can't measure what they want what they can measure. We want to avoid that, so let's give them something they can measure that helps decrease that cycle time. I want to dive into specialists and generalists a little bit more, and I'm going to do it on the board even before I have an official demo slide coming up. So let's step over to the board, if you would, because I think that this is it's kind of an interesting way to think about things, because Agile has exposed this craziness to the world. And this is the craziness. Let's see. I'm going to use green as my specialists. So here's my specialist. Well, green with a black pen. I'm going to use black as my specialist. So here's a specialist. And in order for her to do work, if I want to keep her busy, I need to give her a pile of work to do. Why? Because she can deliver it really, really quickly.
And you also don't know how long each individual piece is going to take.
Right.
So you've got to have a pile.
Yeah, and because she's so good at what she does, I have to give her a pretty big pile because she's going to rip through it in an incredible speed. Now, let's take our generalist, and I'm going to make them blue in this case. So I'm going to put a generalist up here, and a generalist doesn't take as much stuff. Right, I can give a generalist three things to work on. Why? Well, let's give him a little bit more. Let's not make him that bad. I'll give him five things to work on.
Not bad. Just system optimized as opposed to locally optimized.
Okay, system optimized. Yeah, that's true. Good point. So if this is the same type of work, if this is building database stored procs, the specialist is going to build a lot more of them than a generalist would. So I don't need to give them as much stuff. But here's the interesting thing. If I take specialists and I group them so that I have multiple specialists on the same team, let me add just another specialist over here. That specialist has to have their backlog. But what's interesting is as soon as they are coupled, as soon as this person depends on the work product of the other person, because now there's variation, in order to keep them busy, I've got to stack up and give each of them more work to do to guarantee that that specialist is working. This is why specialists outperform generalists pretty dramatically, yet generalist teams outperform specialist teams. Drives me crazy, because people think, we're gonna hire a bunch of really good specialists and we're gonna lump them all together in a room.
And it'll work.
And it'll go even faster than if we hired generalists. But let's take a look at our generalist again. Let me take my blue pen, my generalist pen, and add another generalist. What happens to their queue of work as a generalist? Well, they have some work. They don't have as much because they're not quite as fast. But there is a dependency between them, right? They may not have to flow between them, but now as a team, they're sharing work. What's interesting is because I formed a team, they need less WIP to keep them busy as a group than they did as individuals. Why? Because Andrew, when you run out of work,
work.
He walks right over to me and grabs my work.
But this can't grab her work.
Yep, he can't grab hers because they're tied in specialists. As soon as you have generalists of any nature, even if they're just, if they're T-shaped generalists, it's even better. You know, they're really effective, but they can at least do something. Once you have that, you can lower your overall work in process. That's why when someone comes to me as a developer and says, you know, I've got some experience testing too. I don't really use it that often, but I'm, you know, I test as well. That sets a nice little flag right. that goes, whoa, they understand something just outside of their domain such that if I get stuck and I can't test fast enough, they can jump in and help test for me.
Can I go on a little rant about this one? So this one's one
sure.
of my, so one of my favorite pastimes, this is kind of an odd pastime, but one of my favorite pastimes is I like to look through advertisements for job openings for developers, right? I look through them all the time. Probably once a day in the evening, I look through them just to see what they look like.
And which almost, disturbs me as someone who's employed.
As he's my boss, that probably finds that disturbing, but this is why I do it. I find it, the phrasing in them is so interesting. They're always looking for the super uber rockstar DBA awesome who can do everything SQL ever created and thought about in SQL. You don't need someone that is that specialized. If you had someone who actually was that good and stuck them on your team, they'd be bored out of their minds for 95% of their time because your work isn't that hard. I'm sorry. But in general, you want someone who's slightly better than average. Anyways, but if you hire a bunch of crazy specialists who are specialized that much, and then you put them on a cross-functional team, your management overhead goes through the roof. No longer can you worry about just giving a team a piece of value and say, go figure out how to deliver this value to my customers. You can't do that as a manager. If you've got teams of specialists, you have to worry about, okay, so I've given them a database heavy piece. I also need to pull this lower priority item because that's a little UX heavy so I can keep my UX guy optimized. Oh, but the .NET developers, they need a little bit more work. So, well, this thing, really, we really weren't going to get that done for another 3 months, but let's pull that in since my .NET developers are going to have capacity this sprint. If you have to play that game, you know that you have way too many specialists on your team. The management overhead for that is just mind-boggling. You spend all of your time worrying about making sure that your specialist has enough specialized work to fill their specialist queue. That's just not a happy place to be.
It's not a happy place.
But it cracks me up going through the advertisements for all of these managers who are writing these advertisements, and they want more of them. And it's completely the opposite of what they should be looking for. You should be looking for somebody who fits well in your team and is willing to jump in and do a manual test. A mediocre developer who can do manual tests and not complain about it is gold. You want more of them.
Yep.
Not more really angry, super code ninja, uber rockstar ninja with all these other weird words that you just made up to stick in your advertisement. You don't want them. 90% of the time, they're not going to fit in your team.
So,
all right, rant over.
That's awesome. I agree. It's one of those things where you need to balance that specialization and the benefits you get from specialization as a trade-off to the benefits you get from generalization. And like anything else, it's a U-shaped optimization. We need to fall somewhere in the generalist specialist, probably not totally generalist, probably not totally specialist, but those T-shaped individuals. Yep. So I'm going to give another example. This is the one that we'd had planned. It's my one bug per tester. It's a demo. I'm not even going to go to the board for this one. I'm just going to go right here. This was a customer we had, and they kind of blew me away. I was showing off some of the cool testing features that are available in Microsoft Test Manager and was kind of showing those things. And they looked at that and said, man, those are powerful bugs that get created. I'm like, yeah, I know. When are you going to roll it out? Well, we won't. Like, but you're using TFS. You're all it's Microsoft Shop. It's ideal. Why? And they said, oh, we don't have bugs to speak of. And I was like, what do you mean you don't have bugs? And they walked me through what I thought was a very interesting thing. They're in the medical field, and quality is fairly important for them, as you might imagine. But it doesn't just apply to the medical field, but this is what they did. They said, we want high quality, and bugs in our software are not going to be tolerated. You know, they're just not going to be. We're going to fix them. And they have the devs and the testers working together. And if I'm a tester, I'm sitting down and I'm running through a test. I'm probably not with a developer sitting next to me, but if I discover a bug, I have reached my work in process limit for bugs. I have one bug. Until that bug is fixed and put into the code base, I can't go looking for any more bugs. This is my whip limit. It's pretty extreme. So now what do I do? As that one tester, I walk over to the developer that checked in that code and I say, Andrew, let's fix this bug. And Andrew looks at me and says, great, I'll put away what I'm doing now. Now we've talked about the dangers of preemptively pulling people off work. They did it very specifically. They weighed the optimizations. They said, nope, this is how it's gonna be. Quality is job one. Boom. Andrew's interrupted. We sit down. On his box, I demo the bug. Notice I haven't filed anything. I haven't typed up anything. I haven't spent 45 minutes logging a bug, or even five. Andrew sees the bug. He goes, oh, clearly I know where this is, because it's just been worked on. He opens it up and he fixes it while me, the tester, is watching. One, I get to understand his code and see if there might be other problems. Two, he gets to watch how I test his code so that he won't do that again. And three, the bug gets fixed really, really rapidly. He finishes, I validate, we check in the code, and I go back and I can start looking for more bugs. That work in process limit of one bug, that's pretty revolutionary. But what it's done is it has driven quality so high in that organization that their backlog of bugs is tiny. It's what's been provided by their customers, and it tends to be a very, very short list. This is not a list of 50 or 100 bugs. This is a list of 6 bugs, 10 bugs, 2 bugs. This is a small, manageable list of bugs that get handled at every sprint. It's incredible. But what has that allowed them to do? If you study Capers-Jones, or you read Capers-Jones, he's studied over 20,000 software development projects. What he's found is that the tightest metric that correlates to software development speed is quality. The higher the quality in an organization, the faster that organization is able to deliver features to their customers. And there's one particular metric that he uses. It's a defect removal efficiency as a proxy for quality. But that basically, high quality means high speed. Why? You don't have failure demand coming in, you know, having to fix bugs. You can focus on those high features. How did they do it? They said, we make quality the most important thing, and we take one bug, me as a tester, that's all I get. I think it's brilliant.
Right.
Now, if Andrew was on vacation for 6 months, or 6 weeks, or he left the company, I'm going to go and find another developer to interrupt, right? But if he's gone for a day, I don't get another developer.
Right.
I start automating my unit tests, or automating my functional tests. I start doing test planning. I do something different.
Right.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's a great example of a company that weighed a trade-off and then made a system-level optimization over a local-level optimization. Because if you looked at the efficiency rate of testers in that organization, you'd find that it's insanely low, right? Lots of times they're watching developers code and not actually testing. But the system efficiency is much higher. And that's the important thing to remember here. Now, just to be clear, we're not saying that all of you should go out and impose a one bug per tester rule in your organization. It's an example that highlights that when you weigh trade-offs in your organization at the system level, it's okay to decide to be locally inefficient in order to improve system efficiency.
Yep. So that brings us to our bottom line.
It's generally not a bad idea.
Yeah. And that brings us to the bottom line is that we should emphasize, focus on, and manage units of value, not pieces of work. As I've matured in the agile kind of mindset, and I've got a long ways to go, right? Everyone does. It's a big, long journey. And as I've matured on that, I've started to care less and less and less about task breakdowns and hours breakdowns, and to care more and more about the user story or the product backlog item or whatever that small unit of value is. Someone in the comments, Shuhari.
Right.
Shuhari, a thing that Alistair Coburn quoted, and I think it's probably worth bringing up here when we start just to talk about Agile. The concept of Shu is you're a student that needs to be taught and follow exactly what the master is telling. In other words, you know absolutely nothing about Agile. You're brand new. You know what? Pick up a book on XP, pick up a book on Scrum, follow them exactly as they are written. Follow those rules so that you can understand it and start to internalize it. Ha is the people who now are beginning to move beyond just the master's teaching, as Alistair Coburn puts it, and say, I need to start reaching out to other ideas and pulling in other influences from other people, other ideas, other principles. That's that ha stage. And then you're at the re stage, and those students are the ones who have become masters themselves and are now learning from their own experience and driving that forward. I would say that where we are in this course is really focused on the ha, that middle. If you have never heard of Agile before, these lean fundamentals, as we've explained, are probably a little too far down the road. Once you've understood Agile, you've kind of internalized some of those, we're at this point where we're starting to want to challenge some of those ideas and start to find out why they exist. And that's where we are here. And you might be at the re place where you are a student of lean and you're taking your own learnings and driving the field forward. Again, that's probably then a little bit beyond what we're doing here today. You know?
Exactly.
If you're Don Reinertsen.
Thanks for showing up. We really appreciate it. I love your work.
Exactly. Excellent. So that's the bottom line. Let's wave our cultural flag if we would. Basically, this piece, this very piece, this optimization at the global level versus the lower level, frankly, this is the big one. And everything you've heard about all those companies that you want to go work for, that's what happens with this type of change when you start to look not just at the individual optimization but across the board. I know this one feels a little bit fluffy as a cultural flag, but it's true, right?
It's true. It's fluffy and true at the same time, which is the best kind of fluffy, right?
Exactly.
Like all the places that you've ever that you hear about are super awesome and they do all these cool things and they work on all these cutting edge technologies and blah blah blah. It's all because they look at the system and they optimize for the system and they deliver value to their customers and everybody in the organization is actively engaged in building stuff that impacts customers. I've actually worked with a couple line of business application places that were building line of business apps that were the epitome of this. You'd never hear about them along with Facebook and Twitter and those sorts of places and Microsoft and industry leaders like that. But they're building line of business applications that their customer are their internal business. And they just cultivate this culture of we deliver value and we worry about how we can coordinate together to deliver value. Not, well, my piece is done. Steve, your turn.
Exactly.
I've got a new piece. I'm going to work on my new piece. That's
so
not
that,
any fun. It's just really not any fun at all.
It's not fun. So that wraps this section where we talked about system optimization over individual optimization and system throughput over individual efficiency. Next, that wraps up all of our principles sections. From now on, we're moving to the practices, and these are the how-to pieces of this. These also have key theoretical foundations as well, but we're going to be now diving into the practices, the specifics of the things that you're going to drive forward with. We'll see you in 10 minutes.